Yes, I was fired. It happens to most coaches. Well, what are you going to do? Are you going to just lie there in the fetal position and whimper?
Welcome to Head Games Radio with our special exclusive interview with perhaps, and I think most people would give him the vote. If this was a presidential election, John Schuerholz, I think most people would say you are the winner of the election, is the best general manager in baseball because of your consistency, the way that you've been able to win for two different teams, two different leagues. Thanks for coming on the show in the midst of the season, sir.
Thank you, Nick. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome, and you've written a great book, Built to Win, and I thought what we'd do is travel down memory lane. I mean, there I was in Kansas City in the 80s, and we were not the best team in the world back in the mid-80s, and it was a nice respite for us. I remember we played a pair of games on the weekend surrounding the World Series, and we'd get our rear ends kicked in the midst of a losing streak on a Sunday. I'd go over with Dean Vogelaar and sit there and watch the World Series, and it was such a pleasure to watch that team in 1985, the Kansas City Royals that you put together. And there's a team that really, I think, helps underscore a lot of the themes I want to talk about with you today, which is a team in Kansas City, most people would argue today, cannot win, has no chance to win a World Series. But back then, you pulled it off. How did you do that?
Well, first off, I dispute that contention that a team in Kansas City can't win. We'll get to that in a minute. Back in 1985, we did that through the way that Dayton Moore, the current general manager of the Kansas City Royals, who worked here as my assistant for 10 years, will put together that organization, re-strengthen that organization, and focus on a productive and consistent scouting and player development program so that you have a pipeline filled with quality players that you know their character, you know their work ethic, you know their adaptability, you know their athleticism, you know their winning spirit, you know their competitiveness, you know all of that, and you train them the way you want the game played, and when you bring them through your pipeline to your major league club, you do it with great confidence and great reliability. And they provide the foundation upon which you build by adding free agents and making good trades, if you're fortunate, and you supplement that. But that's the essential ingredient. And in 1985, we did that. We had a lot of our guys came bubbling up through the Kansas City Royals' great farm system, and we were able to make a couple deals. We added Jim Sundberg as the quarterback of our young pitching staff. I thought that was an important deal for us to have to make because we had guys like Saberhagen and Gubaza and Danny Jackson and young guys on that pitching staff that needed to be quarterback through a game. We had real consistent offensive performers. We had a Hall of Famer in George Brett. All of the pieces meshed so well together, and that's a key thing for a general manager, is finding not necessarily the most talented player in any deal or acquisition you make, but finding the most talented player that meshes his abilities and his emotional and character issues with your team and makes your team fiber stronger. And that's the way we did in 1985. We were not the best team, most talented team, I should say, excuse me. We were the best team, because they played so well as a team.
And that's one of the things we talk about on the show all the time, whether it's with Mike D'Antoni, who has come within a hair lash of going all the way with a team that was nowhere 2 years ago. And what you notice in sports, whether it's the Patriots, whether it's Florida in the NCAA, you know, whether it's in Major League Baseball, the teams that are truly teams that understand and that have an intelligence on the field, those are the teams that are beginning to win. They can think on the field. I think of a Teddy Bruschi as a great example of the kind of player. And if there was a Teddy Bruschi for the Atlanta Braves or for, let's go back to the Royals, who would that have been? Who is the person that had that sort of on-game intelligence that, through that leadership, helped make sure the other guys were engaged mentally as well?
That's an easy one. It was George Brett. For us, I mean, George, sure. Not only by his awesome physical ability that separated him from most mere mortals wearing a baseball uniform, but it was his passion, his commitment, his work ethic, and his joyful countenance about being a Major League Baseball professional.
He just loved the
athlete.
Game, didn't he?
He loved the game. He loved practicing the game. He loved improving his game. He loved competing and succeeding, as he did so many, many times in his life. So that was an easy one for me. Here, I'd say it's John Smoltz. John's passion for the game, his leadership, his athleticism, his consistency, his toughness fighting through arm injury after arm injury, coming out the other side of it, his reliability, his leadership, all of those things. I'd say John fills that role for us here probably more than any player.
Well, it's wonderful to be able to pick your brain, because I know that even though you were able to win a championship back then, John Schuerholz, you will probably say you've learned a lot of things in 20 years, and you know, the game has changed. Let me ask you this. What was the differential between the payroll available for the Royals and the top team, which was probably the Yankees back then, and what it is today?
Well, there was always a spread. There was always a considerable distance between what the Yankees could pay their players, even back in the mid-'80s, early 80s, late 70s, mid-'70s, because we went up against them, as you know, in playoffs, in American League playoff series, and, you know, and we, you know, I characterize it like a gunfight at OK Corral. At one end is a little kid with a straw hat and freckled face, and he pulls out his pop gun and fires it. And at the other end is this giant guy in a dark outfit with two guns strapped on his hips, all black, leather gloves, with shadow.
Black.
There was the Yankees. And that's the way I characterize it. Steinbrenner didn't like that characterization, by the way, but it's how I looked at it. It's today the separation still remains the same. We have an $80 million payroll. We've won our division 14 consecutive years. We're about ready not to win it this year for the first time in 15 years, which is remarkable on its own merits. But we're $80 million payroll, and the Yankees are over $200 million in payroll. So anybody who knows salt from pepper in putting together a team is going to be able to build a better team theoretically. If you have $200 million up against $80 million, or less than that, $50 million. Now, there are some exceptions, which I'm happy to talk about. A prime example this year is the Florida Marlins.
Let's do that. Okay.
Well, the Florida Marlins are a young team, but what the difference, Nick, is that if you're a team like ours, and like the Yankees, or the Red Sox, or consistently winning teams that have the capability to support the kind of salaries that consistently winning players draw, you're paying for their performance. You're paying for their performance in the financial arena in which we work in baseball, which is absolutely bizarre, but nevertheless, it is what it is. So we pay for that, and you're obligated, not obligated, but you have the need to continue to pay those guys who are your core players, and they're the star players, and so they make more money. Whereas a team like the Florida Marlins, who had no star players that they kept, they started from ground zero, and they were able to put together a low-paying team, remarkably about a $15 million payroll, and they're two games out of the wild card, or a game and a half, or whatever they are now, out of the wild card race in the National League because they went down to ground zero. They were last several years in a row. They drafted well. They filled their pipeline with good young talent. And they're playing well as a team. So it can happen, and that's why I think Kansas City can do that. Minnesota has done it year after year. I also happen to think a town like Pittsburgh can do it with that kind of program in place.
Here's our good friend Michael Wilbon from ESPN's PTI, John, talking about revenue sharing. We're not going to spend all day about this, but I think it's important because the bottom line is you may be able to spot the talent, but you've got to fit it, like in football now as well. You've got to fit it in with in your own mental salary cap as well. Here's Michael Wilbon.
You know, I don't know if you want to regulate it to that degree. I mean, that seems like it might be a little extreme. I mean, I think you want to foster competition within the member clubs, whatever sport it is. I mean, I don't think that anybody should be socialism to the degree that people don't feel they need to compete, that people feel they need to just take the check they get from the broadcast rights and say, okay, that's it. We're flush now. We don't really have to do anything else other than put a team out there. I wouldn't want to see that in any sport, Nick, but I do think what has worked successfully for the NFL is propping up clubs to the point where they are going to have a running start and being competitive every year. That's why I think we see in the NFL more teams go from 6-10 to 10-6. We don't see that as often as baseball. Yes, we're seeing it with the Detroit Tigers now. We don't see it, though, as often in baseball or in the NBA. It takes teams years to climb in the NBA, 3, 4, 5 years. You've seen that with the Wizards, the Clippers, 20 years. It just takes forever. In the NFL, there is at least that incentive to be competitive and know you're not going to be in the red.
That's Michael Wilbon. If you were commissioner of Major League Baseball, and I've been on this show going on record as saying that Bud Selig is probably a very likable person, but I don't believe that he is the best that Major League Baseball can do. If you were the commissioner, What would you do to make it more competitive in the ways that have kept the NFL vibrant, kept the fans believing that every single year their team has a shot?
Well, the difference is, of course, Major League, National Football League has a salary cap, and they have revenue sharing across the board. Major League Baseball, long before Commissioner Selig took his seat in that office, was bound by a system that was negotiated with the Players Association that our Players Association will never give up. It is not as good a system for the owners. It is more challenging. It is more financially demanding. In all of the other major sports now, hockey, basketball, football, especially as you know, the percentage of salaries paid to players is tied to the percentage of industry revenue. We don't have that. We have to do it ourselves.
Do you wish you had that?
Pardon me? Absolutely.
Do you wish you had that?
That's the only system that makes sense. That's why every other league in the world has it but us. It's the only one that makes sense. The players should share in the amount of revenue generated. And you have to make the assumption that there are advanced accounting practices that everybody, the brains of the union and the brains of management, could sit down and say, okay, we agree that this is the way the accounting will be done, and here's when we decide on how much revenue is generated by the industry, we'll negotiate for what percentage of that revenue stream we think our players ought to get, and you sit down and you negotiate, and I think that fixes. Now, in addition to that particular nuance of baseball, we also have the circumstance of we support a very full and very costly minor league development program. None of the other teams, hockey has maybe a minor league team or two, but they're very inexpensive and fairly cost efficient, has the kind of investment in R&D, research and development, that we are obligated to have because of the minor league system that's in place. I wouldn't change that, but it has to be recognized and appreciated in the negotiated settlement.
We're going to go to a break. When we come back, John Schuerholz, one of the great role models, I think, for general managers, and we've been lucky to have a Theo Epstein and a Josh Burns. We're going to try to pick your brain, John, a little bit more about what you've learned over the last 21 years since you were with the Royals and won that first championship, of course, the 95 championship with Atlanta, and breaking through the way that Theo Epstein did with the Red Sox, breaking through the Yankee hold, if you will. When we come back, John Schuerholz, general manager for the Atlanta Braves. We'll be right back.
Join Head Games Radio. Call 800-878-PLAY. That's 800-878-7529. And now, here's your host, Nick Lowry.
Welcome back to a special edition. It's always special here, but it's particularly special here. And by the way, you can listen to the clips from today's show, from yesterday's show with Michael Wilbon, Monday's show with Chris Berman at headgamesradio.com. If you're looking for a really great website designer, go to drivendesignsolutions.com. We also want to thank ticketsnow.com for providing the gift certificates to our regular contributors on this show. But back to what makes you special, John Schuerholz, which I think absolutely bar none is your ability to put together the best pitching staff in Major League history over 10 years. And let's face it, John Smoltz is still there, but besides him, the names that are obvious are Glavin and Maddux. Here's a quote from Jim Beattie about the qualities of the thinking man's pitcher. We want to talk with you about Leo Mazzoni. We want to talk about Jack Llewellyn, and we're also joined by Dr. John Elliott, who is one of the top performance experts in the country. John, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much, Nick.
Here's Jim Beattie from just a couple days ago.
Years.
Well, I think when I think of pitchers that are smart pitchers out there, they're guys that aren't power pitchers. They can't rely on the 92-plus mile-an-hour fastball to ride it up and in on a hitter. It's a guy like a Greg Maddux, you know, a Jamie Moyer, a Tom Glavin. You know, the interesting thing about Maddux, I often listen to, post-game interviews or read a post-game comment from him, and he may have a very good game, but what he'll often say is, I was lucky, I didn't stick to my game plan, I wasn't able to make some of my pitches. He is as self-critical a player as there is in the game today. He understands where his success lies, and sometimes he understands that it's better to be lucky than good, and he brings that out to the mound when he goes out there. He understands that he needs to work hitters a certain way, and work counts a certain way, and pitch around hitters a certain way and pitch and be more aggressive to some hitters in tight situations than others. He kind of understands everything that's going on through there, and I think the advantage is obviously he's been in the game for a long time, and he's learned a lot and retained a lot. He's had some and played with some great players and other pitchers, and he takes a lot into, you know, kind of into his experience. He gets a lot of his knowledge from having talked to other players that he's played with, and he had a great pitching coach in Atlanta when he was there, and Leo Mazzoni, and they worked well together.
That's Jim Beattie. John, as you listen to that, I mean, obviously Smoltz had a great fastball. Almost no pitchers, besides maybe Eckersley, have been able to go back and forth between a starting role and a relieving role with the kind of efficiency that he has. But let's talk, first of all, about putting together that staff early on when you came to Atlanta with Maddux and Glavin, and what makes them so special.
Well, Smoltz and Glavin were here when I got here the winter of 1990, and we signed Greg Maddux in 1993, but... I learned when I started my career with the Baltimore Orioles in 1966, and when we built championship teams in Kansas City for those 23 years back there, it was around pitching and defense and athleticism, and that's what we've done here. When I took the job here, the Braves had already in place a pipeline full of very talented young pitchers. We added Greg Maddux, who became the bell cow and the leader of that staff, and performed so admirably for us for those 10 years and really set the standard. Hall of Fame level standard for all of our pitching. And this year is a sort of an abject reality check up against what we've done in the past with good pitching. We've not been able to pitch as well for a variety of reasons, and the results are what they are. We're struggling to stay in a race even for a wild card, but pitching has always been the cornerstone of any foundation of any team that I've been a part of, and we intend to focus on that again next year.
John Elliott, you studied those people in the game that helped put together the sense of confidence and consistency. Tell us your insight into Jack Llewellyn and what he brought to the Braves.
Well, originally he came in, and John got him involved working with Smoltz when he was having an off season in 91. And, you know, my experience working with Jack and Bob Rotella and some of those folks that, you know, were helpful and part of that system were, you know, they fit in nicely in providing some expertise, and one of the things that we know in sports psychology is that you have very clearly defined roles in terms of what you work on and how you work with coaches and players, and it's not some hocus-pocus lay somebody on the sofa and talk about their mother sort of thing. And, you know, Jack has a straightforward approach, and John can speak to him because, you know, he worked with him for so many years, but, you know, no-nonsense approach that athletes appreciate, that the focus on bottom-line results and that sort of approach as opposed to what we think of as traditional, quote-unquote, therapy.
Why don't you give us your insight into Leo Mazzoni, what he brought to the staff back then, and what your strategy is now, John, in terms of bringing along the pitchers that may not have the pedigree of a Maddux or a Glavin?
Well, Leo did a remarkable job for us. He was an outstanding pitching coach. He left to pursue his desires, that is to be with his lifelong buddy, Sammy Perlazzo, the manager of the Orioles. They've known each other since 5 years old. Leo's elderly parents and his family from his previous marriage, or from his only marriage, he's divorced, but are back there. So he wanted to be there. The Orioles wanted him, and we didn't stand in his way. And quite candidly, I think after as long as Leo was here, or anybody's at a job for that length of time, change is probably refreshing, not only for the person, but for the environment that he's been in and for the environment he comes to. And Leo did a remarkable job, and he was a big part of our success, and we tip our cap to him, but the time had come. And we were fortunate to get who we think a young guy in Roger McDowell, who has all of the capabilities, all of the potential to develop into one of the fine pitching coaches. He's a great communicator. He's got a great personality. He's very interactive with players. He's very approachable. And so the players, veterans and young alike, have responded very well to Roger. We've not pitched very well, but that's not at all a reflection of Roger's pitching coach ability. It's a reflection of the caliber of the players we've had to give the responsibility of pitching to. We just haven't had that high level of we thought we did, but we had some injuries. And things didn't work out as well as we thought. But I think the world of Roger, and think he's going to be an outstanding major league pitching coach in short order.
John Cherholtz, Theo Epstein had a very thoughtful interview a couple weeks ago, and we asked him also, because you're not the manager, Bobby Cox has, it seems to me, just looking at his body language, let alone what he says to his players, that he has a sort of fatherly, even keel that you've got to have, but the general manager does as well. But up in Boston, and many people, Michael Wilbon has joked about the kind of obsession with the Red Sox and the Yankees, but up in Boston, there was that need to find a way for the players to relax and be themselves. I wanted your comment on what he had to say.
He'd do his own thing.
Yeah, back in 04, we made a conscious decision to kind of let the guys be themselves and have fun, whether it was growing out their hair, wearing their uniform a certain way, and try to create a bit of a free spirit in our clubhouse. For years, you know, the Red Sox, I think, have suffered by the intensity of the media scrutiny, both physically in the clubhouse and in spirit with the way the team is covered and how it's reflected in the marketplace. So giving guys some freedom, letting them have fun, I think really went a long way that year in helping them get past some of the scrutiny and really focus on themselves and what they were doing. And by the time the game rolled around, it was just another extension of the fun they were having.
What do you try to do with Bobby Cox? I mean, I know you give him a free rein to a large extent, but there are times when pressure is going to beat down on a team that's playing 162 games, it's got the playoffs ahead, that has the media scrutiny at a higher level than ever before. Tell me what you think of Theo Epstein's comments about what he did to loosen up that Boston Red Sox team.
Well, I think it all depends on the personality of your team. If you have players that you can feel confident that you can unleash them and let them run free, spirit with free spirited, with their hair wild and earphones on during a game and things like that. If you feel comfortable that those kind of guys can still maintain their focus and play baseball the way it needs to be played, then that's fine. I particularly am of the impression that if you allow, you're taking the real chance that it may go beyond anyone's control, yours as a general manager or even the most strong-willed manager, you have to really be careful in allowing that to take place. Because one of the things about baseball is the word uniform. We believe that our players have to understand, have the same vision, have same goals, do things in a uniform fashion, know where what each player's responsibility is, be supportive of that, and not just be off wild and being individualistic. I think baseball teams that succeed have an understanding of the team concept better than those who are a bunch of individuals. And so, what Theo said was his observation of the bunch of guys he had there was obviously right. They won the world championship for the first time in 100 and whatever years. But I think you have to be careful making those kind of decisions and assuming that you're going to be able to rein back in this freedom that's been allowed a bunch of individuals.
Well, we only have a couple minutes, John. Appreciate your giving us your time. I wanted to ask the other John Elliott. You have written in your book and you've documented what a difference it made, for instance, for George Mason and Jim Larrañaga to be able to relax and play stickball, for instance, before their games. Tell us, and I like John, your comment, John Cherholtz, your comments on this. Dr. Elliott, what is the most important ingredient that a general manager working with his manager can do to allow the players to be relaxed and yet alert, you know, to be in that state where they can be at their highest level of play and be most consistent for the longest period of time?
Well, Nick, I think it's focusing on sort of the fundamental and the concrete strategies that you can use to help the players get in that loose, trusting, use their mind a little less type of approach to the game. In other words, you got great coaches, you got great general managers. They can do a lot of the analysis and work on strategy, and they can do a lot of the quote unquote thinking and let players be instinctive and use all their years of training and everything they did in spring training, the off season, and rely on that to be there in what we call a trusting fashion, without having to overthink things and overanalyze and get themselves tight and less athletic because of that approach. And a great manager and a great general manager can do that for athletes. And every team is different, and as John is saying, you got lots of different personalities, so it's really thinking through what are the concrete strategies to do that. It's not just, hey, let's let them go play, you know, stickball and streetball and you know, free it up. You got to free it up to something specific, and that's a specific strategy that you want to execute.
John, is this still fun for you?
For me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, this is my 45th year in the game. I'm my 25th as a general manager. Lord knows the circumstances and the work environment has changed on a lot of fronts, financial and agents and media, et cetera, et cetera. But it's still fun, and because it's fun for me because team building, as we're talking about, is what I enjoy most and I find the most challenging and the most stimulating, and trying to find the right pieces and the right personalities that fit together and mesh together to be the best teams, whether or not they are necessarily the most expensive players or the best talent individually, is not the matter. What is the matter is whether they play the best as a team.
Final question for you, my friend. We'll let you go. Who is you, besides yourself, who do you believe and have the most respect for as a general manager in Major League Baseball?
Well, I mean, I think Walt Jocketty has done a remarkable job in St. Louis in a sort of an understated way. I think Terry Ryan in Minnesota has done a remarkable job. I think Larry Beinfest, a young guy coming on the scene, has really shown that he can get the job done. Pat Gillick back in Philadelphia. There are a lot of guys out there that are very talented people, very smart, very hardworking, and very intuitive about how to create teams. And so I think the game is blessed to have as many talented people at the general manager spot.
Well, we've been blessed to have you and hope that maybe in a few months we can pick your brain after the season and see where you're going with the Braves for next year. Thank you, sir. Appreciate
it. Thank you. Thank you very much.
John Cherholz, Atlanta Braves, and what a great opportunity.